You are listening to a Science Actually production.
Is your microphone working?
My microphone should be working. Ooh. Oh, yeah. The crisp sounds of Covey and Benjamin brought to you by whatever ad we have this week.
Hello.
Air my. We should pick an episode and do the entire thing. I'll do it in an American accent. You do it in an Australian accent. And we just confuse our listeners.
Well, yes. I just think you would endear yourself to the American audience, and I will offend the Australian audience.
Speaking of our endearing audience, welcome, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, to another silly episode of Science Actually Presents the Nerd and the Scientist. Ah, what are we
we'll
talking
get to a serious one soon enough. But
oh, eventually.
Eventually. Surely. Sure.
Oh, gee. Excuse me. It sounds like your throat's feeling like it's a little bit, there's a bit of dust in there, maybe a little bit of gas.
A little messy.
Little messy. Messier than usual.
Messier than usual, yes. That's right, everybody. Today, we're talking about all sorts of things that are in space. Golly gee, supernova remnants and star formation and Messier objects.
Yes. I was about to say that, like, folks might need to wait a few minutes for that segue to become clear.
Yeah, exactly. Charles Messier was an Argentine professional soccer player, widely regarded as one of the greatest footballers of all time.
But what have you done for me lately?
Messi. We met Messier. Sorry. No. Charles Messier is an 18th century French astronomer, best known for creating the famous Messier catalog. He was given the task of looking for comets, see if he could discover comets. And he cataloged 110, some on his own, some with help, objects in the sky that he believes were potential comets. 13 of them were.
So my understanding of like what's truly impressive about the Messier catalog is that he was actively going out of his way to find things that he first mistook for comets and then was like, no, these are definitely not comets. They're just like these weird nebulous smudges. We don't care about them. And for modern day astronomers, these have turned out to be some of the most visually striking and spectacular nebulae and galaxies as well, which wasn't a thing in his time. People did not yet realize that what we know today is distant galaxies. They thought that those galaxies, when they were identified, even once they realized that they were a nebulous cloud of something, they thought, oh, it's just a nebulous cloud of something and maybe some stars, but within our galaxy. And it wasn't until much later that astronomers finally settled the fact that there are galaxies outside of the Milky Way. I think it was like in the 1920s even.
And some of these things that he found, they were all Messier, starts with the letter M. So they all are named or numbered rather as M1, M2, M3, and so forth. And these are familiar names. Some of you might have heard of or seen in, you know, various news articles, whatever. M1, the first one, it's the Crab Nebula. We all know, we've all heard of that one, the Crab Nebula. M31 is the Andromeda Galaxy. M42 is the Orion Nebula. So a lot of these pictures that a lot of people will see in news articles, or a great many amateur astronomers and professional astronomers that are looking for that beautiful photo or a familiar thing to target, these are cataloged in Messier's lovely, lovely list. And I highly recommend actually looking up the Messier catalog. It's available everywhere on Wikipedia.
Literally.
If you want, NASA.gov has a very nice a showing of the Messier catalog with all the pictures and a lot of information about them. And, you know, what are they? You know, is it a galaxy? Is it a nebula? Whatever. Is it a globular cluster? And it gives you a little bit of information about them. It's actually very interesting.
I'm so jealous of the people who do Messier marathons. Right? Where folks will try to get, you know, try to find with their telescopes every single one of the Messier objects, and just go through the entire catalog like in one night. In the Northern Hemisphere. And it's just, I've never done something like that. I think I would probably fail, because it's weird that like the skillful telescope work that used to be the work of professional astronomers is now the work of amateur astronomers who are incredibly good at that sort of thing. Whereas the quote unquote professional astronomers spend most of their time, you know, doing data science with images and information that come from more automated, you know, massive telescopes all across the globe.
I think I'd like to go tag along on a Messier night, try to go through them all. I think that a marathon, I think that'd be great. I just want to be the guy who runs around. Which one are you looking at? Oh, cool. Next. That'd be awesome. Doing the actual work myself, I don't know. I'll bring everyone coffee and donuts. Just show me what you got.
I love it. Love it. That'd be fun. The Crab Nebula, which you mentioned, M1, the Crab was actually the first astronomical object that I ever observed with my own hands with a radio telescope, actually.
Cool.
Yeah, I spent a summer at Caltech when I was an undergraduate, and the doctoral student who was guiding me and helping me, we went out and we used this telescope that he was building, and we, you know, set up the telescope, and it was this huge array of a bunch of different radio dishes that he was building. And then we basically programmed the observation, we got it going, and then it was just mind-blowing to me. Also, we did it during the day, which now, as a radio astronomer, just makes sense. But at the time, it's like kind of counterintuitive. You don't think about how radio astronomers are observing during the day. And so it's just like beep, boop. And, you know, a few lines of Python code later, I see this curve that's basically the rise and fall of the Crab Nebula and its radio light that it's producing as it you know, crosses the sky above the telescope. It was good fun.
I have to like that it goes beep boop.
Yeah, beep boop. That is, everybody knows that every Python code worth its salt has to go beep boop at some point. If your code does not beep boop, it is broken.
If you get a good beep boop, then all your radio telescopes are perfectly in tune and you're ready to do observations.
It's like the equivalent of revving your engines if you're a NASCAR driver. Got to get
okay.
A beep, yeah, I'll beep, buy that. Beep, boop. Yep. I actually have that in my some of the code that I have that takes a little bit longer to run. I'm searching through large catalogs for detections of particular supernovae or whatever. I have a little snippet in there that when the code finishes running, play this sound bite. And they often use like things from a Mario on. NES, or like, you know, old video game sounds. Most recently I have the Pac-Man sound, so every time I can, you know, I set a code running and I'm you know, click clacking away on some other thing, and then suddenly I'll hear, woo, 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 woo. Ah, yes, my code is finished. But anyway, enough of that tangent.
No,
let's just how we got
video there. Game. So, what does Galaga mean?
Galaga.
If you hear Galaga, what does it mean? You stumbled upon a nebula or something, or region.
I assume that I bumped into somebody of Irish heritage.
Oh, that takes that.
Or is that Galaga? Not Galaga. An Australian accent.
Galaga. I'm a lot older than Kavi. Sigh.
it was a good shooter arcade game for its time, but I don't know. I grew up more on like, what was it called? Point Blank.
Oh, that
is. Never mind. We've turned this from a Nebula episode to a nebulous, amorphous shooter game. Yes.
There's different types of nebulae. That's why we're using the plural. Can't say the different type of nebulas.
Yes.
Different types of nebulae. Because pinky's out, you got to say science words right. Nebulae.
Nebulae.
What kind of types of nebulae are there? Kavi.
Oh, okay. And you were going to try to track me.
Different kinds.
No way.
I made that up. There are not.
Best I can do is four and maybe a stretch for like a fifth and a sixth. Okay, so there are dark nebulae which have been pulled to the dark side by evil forces.
Yes.
There are emission nebulae.
Right.
There are giant molecular clouds. There are reflection nebulae. There's this type of nebula that's not really a nebula, called a Harrow-Hico, or Harrow something. Basically, these two gents who figured out that you can have like a fake nebula that would be created as a result of really powerful jets of material being launched off a new young star, and it interacts. And like a lot of nebulas are created by like stuff shooting off a thing and hitting the stuff around the thing that shot them off. So that's another type of nebula. And yeah, within that you have like H2 regions and planetary nebulae, which we spoke about, I think, on a previous episode. That have
we did.
Nothing to do with planets.
Yes. I learned that a planetary nebula looks like a protoplanetary disk, but it's not. It looks similar, hence the name, but it's not
that. Yeah.
I'm going to have you pass along a note from me to the rest of the astronomers saying, you guys got to step up your naming conventions. It's confusing.
I mean, it's not just the naming conventions. It's also like the allocation of particular letters or acronyms to multiple things, right? So there are just not enough letters, and we, even though we use the Greek letters, there's just not enough. Because like you can have alpha being an angle, but you can also have an alpha particle, but you can also have H alpha emission, which is one of the spectroscopic emission lines that you would see from hydrogen. So it's like alpha, alpha, alpha. But also with acronyms, the last type of nebula that I could think of is called a supernova remnant, an SNR. But SNR also refers to a signal-to-noise ratio when you're trying to measure something. So it's like, well, what are you going to do? There's too much stuff in the universe. We need less stuff.
Is there a signal-to-noise ratio for supernova remnants?
Yes. You got to have an SNR, SNR. I know. That's why we normally use sigma. We say a detection is you know, 5 sigma if it's 5 times, like the signal is 5 times the noise. That's 5 sigma. But sigma can also mean other things if you're a galaxy astronomer. So, yes,
How does, well, here's a question.
Yes, you in the back.
In my notesing. That's the verb for taking notes. Notesing.
Yes.
Not made up. It's a real word. I made it up. If a supernova is a star that goes kabloom.
Kabloom.
And it sends its, you know, pieces out in every direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So these things are going away from a central point in every possible direction very, very, very fast. If everything is going away from itself,
mm-hmm.
how is it that a supernova or a supernova remnant could then condense to form stars? Or does it contribute to the formation of stars elsewhere?
Oh, okay. That's actually a really good question. Yeah, I see what you're saying. So
he sees what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm picking up what you're putting down, and I'll have a stab at this question, and then we can do an ad break.
Taking a stab.
Yeah. So, as you suggested, supernovae, whether they're, you know, exploding in a symmetric way or an asymmetric way, either way, they're producing like a powerful shockwave of material that, you know, as it launches all this stuff into the interstellar medium, the ISM, and it pushes other stuff that was around the star also further out, and it mixes with the other stuff in the galaxy. And so star formation, as far as nebulae go, generally tend to rely on just mostly hydrogen. Like the more simple atoms are the things that end up forming the stars, because when a star forms, the main thing that it's doing as a protostar and then throughout the majority of its life is fusing hydrogen into helium. And then eventually it fuses helium into heavier elements, and you go all the way up, you know, carbon, oxygen, and up until iron. But, and so the stuff that's heavier that is spread around during a supernova explosion, that could get gravitationally drawn into a new nebula that is a star-forming region within that same galaxy. But a supernova remnant and a star-forming region are not necessarily the same. Like, they're two different sorts of nebulae. It's not like one transitions into, as far as I know. A supernova remnant will never become a star-forming region. What you'll normally have at the center of a supernova remnant is the remnant of the star. So that could be a compact object like a black hole or a neutron star that is the remains of the core of the star that exploded. Mm-hmm. There could also be a companion star that was part of the binary where one of the stars exploded and the companion remained. But yeah, I don't know. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. Is that a thing? You just mentioned that one of the possible things that are left over as a supernova remnant is just a star, the companion star that was there to begin with. That would imply that the other star exploded into nothing. Can that happen? Can a star explode into nothing, or does it have to leave something behind? Can a star completely explode such that all its constituent particles just go away?
I don't think so. So I think that basically when you're looking at a star that's, you know, around the mass of our sun or within a few times the mass of our sun, it will leave behind, not through a supernova explosion, but through a series of events where it sheds its outer layers and produces stuff that's around the star. It will leave a white dwarf compact object. And then that white dwarf can eventually explode in a type 1a supernova if it pulls on material from its companion. If it's more massive than the sun, if it's like 8 to maybe 30 times the mass of our sun, it'll produce a really bright supernova that will, generally speaking, leave a neutron star, which is like the dense core that remains after everything else has exploded out. And this is the stuff that collapsed down and it couldn't collapse any further because there's these subatomic forces, quantum forces that prevent particles of the same energy from sitting on top of one another. So there's like particle physics forces preventing the final gravitational collapse into a black hole. But then if the star before it exploded was like more than 30 times the mass of the sun, it can overcome that force. And it'll be a kind of a straight to black hole collapse where you'll probably not even see a supernova because the explosion before it gets bright actually is an implosion. And so if it can completely implode and collapse into a black hole, we won't see a supernova. In some rare cases, there can be like a small supernova and then it collapses back into the black hole. But generally speaking, the explode into nothingness that you're describing would only be an observed phenomenon that we see because it was a really massive star, more than 30 times the mass of our sun, that exploded, but it technically imploded and collapsed into a black hole. So there's still something there. We just didn't see it. Yeah. The more you know.
All right.
That was good. For our listeners, Benjamin's just like smiling. Like there's like, it's more than just the penny has dropped. Like this was like $100 bill that's dropped and he just looks giddy.
I'm just very happy. I went to a baseball game last night and the Toronto Blue Jays were here and what a, just a great group of fans. Just the happiest, funniest people, just genuinely there, not to get drunk or anything, but just to enjoy and have fun and laugh. And I was so thrilled to be there and I've just been riding this high and now I'm learning new things and I'm even happier. So go everything. I'm feeling good.
While you continue riding that high of the baseball game and my explanation of stellar collapse, let's maybe have a quick ad break and then we can continue on this nebulous journey.
All right.
Lost in a nebula? Feeling a little lost in the cosmic dust? Well, don't worry because you're not alone. Literally, millions of light years alone. But fear not, space explorers, because here at Nebula Navigators, we'll get you out of that colorful mess. Eventually. Nebula Navigators, help! I'm stuck in the Trifid Nebula. My ship's busted. I'm surrounded by swirling pink and blue gas. Hi, Bob. This is Cal from Nebula Navigators. Don't panic. We'll get a crew out to you as soon as we can squeeze them into our schedule. We're a bit booked at rescuing overly enthusiastic comet chasers this week. Booked? But I'm running out of space snacks. Look, Bob, nebula rescuing takes time. Gotta navigate these cosmic traffic jams, avoid rogue pulsars, you know the drill. Think of it like waiting for a spaceship-sized tow truck, but with a much prettier view. Fine. How long are we talking? Well, let's see. Trifid Nebula, got a factor in the traffic around Betelgeuse. Anywhere between 3 and 12 fortnights. Fortnights? Hey, on the bright side, you have plenty of time to catch up on your nebula gazing. Nebula Navigators. We may not be the fastest, but we'll get you home. Eventually. Probably. Mostly. Remember, pack plenty of space snacks. Nebula Navigators, because getting lost in space shouldn't be a drag.
Brilliant.
Terms and conditions apply. Delays may vary due to wormholes and space-time anomalies. Nebula Navigators, because space is confusing.
I liked it.
I wasn't that sure was if funny. I should do the back and forth bit.
Oh god. I was totally watching Cobby, then I'm taking my pen and paper. I'm trying to take notes on this because it was just too funny. And then I had to stop because it's just nuts. Too many details are happening too fast, and I loved it.
I like these. I really do.
I do. Some of them just really knock you over. I really enjoy them very, 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 very much.
All right, continuing the high from the baseball game to the nebulae to the ad and now back to nebulae. What have you got?
Comedy gold.
Comedy gold,
Jerry. Comedy gold. Anyway, back to where we're speaking of gold. A famous astronomer named Tycho Brahe had a golden nose. He lost his nose back in the 1500s in a duel.
Hey, Benjamin, how did Tycho Brahe smell?
I don't know.
Terrible. Hygiene wasn't great in that century.
It was not. Anyway, there's a supernova called Tycho Supernova. And I had that in my notes. It was in front of me. And I said comedy gold. And I said, oh, that's right. Tycho Brahe is a hero.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people have heard of Kepler's laws, but Kepler, Johannes Kepler, could not have actually figured out and derived Kepler's laws of orbital motion without relying on the measurements and observations that Tycho Brahe had done just earlier.
Beg him for it was a different time, but yes,
a time when people didn't bathe.
No, they did not. There are some stories I've actually read of Tycho Brahe was a very, very, very famous astronomer in his day and had very good measurements. But he was also quite wealthy and he threw very extravagant parties and they got dirty indeed.
So, oh, yes.
Moving along.
Yes, moving along. So Tycho's supernova is an incredible supernova remnant that is just stunning. I mean, if you're listening to this, please stop what you're doing and look up a photo of supernova 1572, Tycho's supernova. It's just spectacular. It almost looks like when you look at like the X-ray image, it's like moss growing on a purple bubble. It's just spectacular.
Could not be a better description. That is exactly what that is.
It's cool. And we can actually see it.
Visual of it?
Yes, I believe so. The Chandra image, if that's what you're looking at.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
So why is the purple bit seem so crisp, but the mossy bits seem so fuzzy? What are the difference between these items?
That is a very good question. I think that what you'd be seeing in the different colors that you're looking at are different frequencies. They correspond to different wavelengths in the observation. And I would imagine that the thing that's producing those sharp purple edges is a physical process that's more like a flat shockwave of the remnant kind of pushing against the interstellar medium, whereas the more tendrily bits are probably caused by instabilities. There are these things called Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities that generally when you have two materials that are shearing or two fluids, so a fluid can be, you know, gases, liquids, stuff in space. So we have two fluids that are shearing next to each other and have different densities, different speeds, different properties. They can create these kind of wispy tendril kind of almost
kind like turbulence.
Exactly like turbulence, yes. Yeah. So that would be my best guess. Yeah.
Right on. Way to go, Tycho. Way to go.
I know.
1572. All right.
Absolutely.
All because I remembered his gold nose. See that, everybody? If you want to be remembered, make your nose gold. And people talk about you for hundreds of years.
Oh, man. All right. Back to nebulae.
Back to nebulae. I'm trying to...
What else do we have from the noting? You're talking about your incredible noting skills, and it seems like they are...
We mentioned the... H2 regions.
Yes.
Regions of ionized hydrogen gas.
Mm-hmm.
If they are regions of gas already around a star, how is it? It's still possible to form yet another star in these regions. Depending, so like it's like the beginning of possibly a binary star system.
So
stars come from in general.
I mean, it's number of stars potentially greater than one. So you can have, you could technically have an H2 region around a single star. I mean, that would be kind of maybe more like a planetary nebula sort of thing. Although I guess in that case, it wouldn't be just like a pure H2 region. There'd be like other stuff there. But yeah, it's more like stellar nurseries, which is a term that I really am quite fond of. So you're expecting lots of stars to be born there. You know, it's a huge region, hundreds of light years across. And often one of the cool ways of studying stars is looking for stars that, you know, most of the stars that we see in constellations are not actually related to one another. They just, their projected location relative to Earth looks like they're nearby. But over long periods of time, the constellations will break up as the stars move in different directions, either closer to us, further away from us, or just like side to side away from each other. But what's really cool is that when you see co-moving groups of stars that all formed in the same stellar nursery, they all formed in the same H2 region. And so those stars over time will move together. And you can actually trace their chemical composition and age and a whole bunch of other properties based on that. So yeah, I think stellar nurseries like H2 regions like the Andromeda Nebula, super cool. 10 out of 10, would recommend. Two thumbs up.
10 out of 10. I was going to actually follow up with that. Since everything in the galaxy kind of moves around the center together, and I was going to ask if stellar nursery, does it just like drop off stars as it goes, or does the stars travel with? So it sounds like they kind of just, do they, when a star forms, it leaves the nursery, but it's still traveling sort of with it. So does it like slow down? Does it go a little slower than the nursery itself?
I would assume that it actually kind of stays roughly on its path. You know, an object of motion stays in motion and all that jazz. If you look at the Orion Nebula, like you see there are stars in the middle, and like it's the whole idea with an H2 region is that it's ionized hydrogen. It's hydrogen gas that there is some intense light that is ionizing it, that is exciting the electrons in the hydrogen and making them bump up a level. And that's normally the stars from within the nursery. So they form, they stay there, they ionize the gas, and that's why it is an H2 region. I think that stars would normally, relative to the galactic center, continue in the trajectory that they were on, that their nursery was on before they were born. At least for stars that form like that. Yeah, it would need to be disrupted by some other, like, really massive.
So the mass was, the matter was going in that direction anyway.
Yeah.
So some, if it condenses, it's still just going together.
Yeah. Okay. Center of gravity of the nebula might change, but otherwise, as a whole, it's kind of moving roughly in the same direction. That's my assumption.
Okay. Some of the more famous examples of well-known star-forming regions. You mentioned the Orion Nebula, but there's also the Carina Nebula, which is a very...
I love the Carina Nebula.
Famous one, and it is home to a great many massive star clusters and a great many very fast famous stars like Eta or Eta Carinae and others. What is it about the Carina Nebula that just makes it churn out so many stellar celebrities, as it were? Why is it like incredibly huge, or is it incredibly dense? Tell me.
It's incredibly pretty. I have, my partner got me a few years ago as a birthday gift, a giant print split into three canvas panels of the of Eta Carina. And it's just, it's stunning. I love it. And that whole region is just very impressive. So I guess to answer your question, it's like very big in size. And I think that just the density, or the initial density distribution when it first formed, like it, I mean, at this point, I think it's one of the biggest nebulae in the sky. So like Orion, the Orion Nebula is about twice the size of the moon in the sky, right? So if you can picture that, it's just not quite as bright as the moon. So the Orion Nebula is twice as big as the moon, and the Carina Nebula, I think, is four times bigger than that. So it's basically like eight times the diameter of the moon. So it's just a really, really massive star-forming region. And I think because of its size and density, it's just allowed a lot of these kind of smaller clusters to form within it, if that makes sense. So you've got Eta Carina, you've got the Keyhole Nebula, you've got this thing called the Defiant Finger, which is a small globule that you might be familiar with, and like some really pretty open clusters, like the Trumpler clusters,
Trumpler?
Which are heavily Trumpler, Trumpler. Like TR, yeah, like a trump card, and then LER.
Okay.
Yeah, it's spectacular. I don't know if that answers your question at all. I'm just here fanboying over it.
I have a follow-up question about nebulae.
Sure. Yes.
How long can nebulae or nebula churn out stars? Does it just keep going until it runs out of material to do so? And if so, are there nebula remnants, like the little last bits that just never got used towards producing a star or any other thing? It just leaves you with traces of gas clouds and stuff.
That's a really interesting question. I'm gonna guess at an answer based on intuition, but it might be completely wrong. And so if there are any folks out there, any other astronomers who maybe work on this sort of stuff that you're listening and you think, that idiot has it all wrong, please write into us and let us know.
Please.
We'll tell you in a moment how you can reach us. But my intuition would be that it would take a very, very long time, hundreds of millions, if not billions of years, for all of the hydrogen in some of these larger nebulas to be used up in the formation of stars. And even then, you would have these star clusters of these, you know, young stars that have just been formed from the nebula that would continue to like ionize the region around it of any of this leftover material. And then I guess eventually you would still have like a really tight cluster, like a stellar cluster, a globular cluster. And then it would just change its properties. I think it's never going to like completely disappear. It would just go from being a star-forming H2 region to maybe some sort of cluster with, you know, different chemical properties, because it's now showing, I don't know, carbon and oxygen lines, because that's the stuff that the stars within it are producing because they've finished burning hydrogen or something like that. And then maybe some of the stars go supernova, and then you end up with a, you know, you have remnants within it, you have black holes within it, like a stellar mass black holes. That's kind of my intuition. It feels right, but it might be wrong.
Universe,
big place. Big enough for the both of us.
Is it possible for nebulae to gain more material, like being fed from something, so it can continue living longer? Or are there such things maybe of like nebula mergers, like two big clumps of stuff just very slowly over long periods of time kind of smooshing together to make a super nebula or something like that?
So there are galaxy mergers, right?
Right. That's why I'm asking that kind of smaller
scale. Thing. It's a thing, but I think, again, this is something that I'm going to work off just my intuition of what I do know to try to answer the question that I don't really know the answer to. So when a galaxy merges, there are billions of stars in each galaxy. And the chances of any of those stars hitting each other are like negligible. If we were to merge with another galaxy, we would not notice. Like, you know, astronomically, stuff would be pretty cool, and astronomers would be having a great time or a terrible time. But like stars and planets, it's basically space, as you said, is really, really big. And so the chances of two stars coming close enough to actually collide, well, to influence each other gravitationally, let alone collide, is very, very, very small. Now, with that being said, nebulae are bigger than stars. You know, they can be hundreds of thousands of times bigger than stars. I still think the chances would be pretty low. And then if you're not looking at a galactic merger situation, you're just looking at within a galaxy, I imagine that what has happened over formation of the galaxy is that you've had some sort of distribution of stuff when the galaxy was forming, and then that stuff condenses into denser regions, and those form nebulae and star-forming regions, and those regions kind of stay on their trajectories, like we were saying before, unless there's some other thing introduced into the system. So there have been, over the Milky Way's history, these mergers of dwarf galaxies or satellite galaxies that have brought their material, their stuff, and merged in with ours. So it may be possible for a nebula to pick up some extra material if there's an interaction like that. But I would say for an old galaxy that's been going for billions of years, I would say it's pretty unlikely. But again, that's just my intuition.
Okay. I accept your answer.
Yes.
Nice. All right. I think we have nebulas. This is good.
Yeah, that's it. We're done. Tick the box. Tick the box. The jewel box. Are you familiar with that one?
The jewel box?
The jewel box. Yeah, it's a star. It's a star cluster. It's a really pretty star cluster. That was actually, I don't know if it was discovered by John Herschel, but I think it was named by John Herschel. And John Herschel, okay, so I always get the family tree mixed up. So John Herschel, the astronomer, was the nephew of William Herschel. And William Herschel and his sister, Caroline Herschel, basically, like they were the, besides Charles Messier, they were like some of the biggest, or maybe even compared to Messier, they were even bigger namers of galactic objects. So there's the NGC catalog, it's like ATM machine. It's just called the New General Catalog, the NGC. And that's a catalog that was put together by John Louis Emil Dreyer. And Dreyer was basically taking all of the work of William and Caroline and John Herschel, their like general catalog of nebulae and star clusters, and combining it and expanding it a little bit. But it's basically like the work that the Herschel family did. And it's, I think, like over 2,500 nebulae that they discovered, like just this one family. Mind blowing. Sorry, I know we're wrapping up. I couldn't go through this episode.
No,
without.
I'm enjoying it. And I love the where you're going, and I looked up a picture of the jewel box, and it is.
It's very, very pretty, right? It's very pretty. I like it. And kudos to Caroline Herschel, who I think was the first woman to ever get a paid salary in England for being a scientist. Got £50 a year. but no, she really was incredible. That was at a time when like very few people were actually getting paid to do science, especially not women.
Yeah.
So yeah, absolutely. Oh, right, you go.
Look it up, everybody.
Okay. Yeah, Caroline
Herschel. Full work this time, everyone. Look up Tycho's supernova and look up the jewel box. And they're all very, very pretty.
They're all really pretty.
Whatever the heck that was. I couldn't figure it out. Find it really fast.
Actually, don't look. In the Carina, if you go to the Wikipedia page for the Carina Nebula, you'll find the various Trumpler star clusters. Trumpler 14 is my favorite. But we'll leave it there. We will let the good people. Oh,
Trumpler 14. All right, now. Wow, my God.
Yeah. Hey, that's what I have on my desk at home.
Okay.
Yeah.
Trumpler 14, Tycho Supernova, and the Jewel Box. Everyone go look those things up right now. We're going to quiz you next time.
Until next week, where can the good people find you, Benjamin?
Kavi, they can find me where I've always been. Look me up under Science Actually on Facebook, on Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, Hive, LinkedIn, Threads. And the ye old YouTube and the new TikTok talks.
Yes. You can find me wherever you find Benjamin by searching Fun Fact Science or at Fun Fact Science. That's my handle. That's my jam. You can find me there. Send us your questions. Send us your queries. Send us your corrections if you heard something that you think, hang on a second. Well, actually. And keep sending us your suggestions for guests. We've got a lot of cool people lined up that we're trying to schedule in interviews for the coming weeks. So we'll hopefully be bringing back some interesting guest astronomers for you guys to get to know.
Awesome.
But until then, we will see you, or you will see us and hear us on future episodes of Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
Night, everybody, or good day, whatever.
Good day.
Good day.
I'll do space first. So, like, I want to know, is like the Canadians made like the space arm for the shuttle, eh? Well, I'd like to know, like, can you use it to open a beer? And can you use it to hold the beer and then, like, bring it up to your mouth? I figure if it was designed in Canada, it's got to be able to open a beer, which means those guys that go up there, the astronauts, are, like, having a beauty time up there with that arm.
Okay, now you tell me. Okay, there's no gravity up there. The beer goes flying up.
So then you just hold your head over it, eh?
Yeah, but you got a helmet on. Okay.